Hello. This is the Pearson EdExcel International GCSE English as a Second Language, Paper 2R Listening Test, Summer 2018. This test is in three parts. You will hear three extracts and will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the beginning of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all three parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1. In this part, you will hear a teacher talking to parents about the school's geography trip to Iceland. Listen and complete the notes. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each completed answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this information meeting on the trip to Iceland. I'm Angus Medler, the head of geography. Let's start with some key times and dates. The trip is from Thursday the 26th of March to Monday the 30th of March. We meet here at the school on the Thursday at 6:15 in the morning for the coach to the airport. Our flight, RJA202, departs at 10:45. For the return journey, we're on flight BA804, departing Reykjavik on Monday afternoon at 3:00, and plan to arrive back here at the school at 10:30. Once we arrive in Iceland, we'll head for the Blue Lagoon for a swim in its warm geothermal waters. We'll then check in at the Vik Hostel and have our evening meal. The following day will be spent on the Golden Circle tour, stopping at Pingvellir National Park and then at the country's parliament. After lunch, the tour continues to Gullfoss, Iceland's most beautiful waterfall, and then to the Geysir geothermal area with its hot springs. The last stop of the day will be a visit to a volcano. On Saturday, we're off to Skaftafell in the south of the country, to explore its famous glacier, the world's largest one outside the polar region. On Sunday, we've arranged a whale-watching tour for a chance to see humpback and minke whales, followed by a trip to the Westman Islands and their cliffs, which are home to 10 million puffins and other seabirds. Monday morning will be spent sightseeing around the capital on foot, before setting off on the journey home. It's certainly a packed itinerary, from which we hope your child will gain an insight into the geology and nature of Iceland. I'd now like to turn to more practical matters. Each student has a baggage allowance of 1 20-kilogram suitcase and 1 piece of hand luggage. This must be a small rucksack. Please make sure all luggage your child brings closes or zips securely to keep valuables and money safe. You'll also need to make sure your child's name is written on their bags to avoid confusion. As for kit, your children will require indoor clothing and footwear for the hostel and flights. They'll also need a waterproof jacket and trousers, thermal layers, robust walking trainers or boots. And please note this does not include anything with plastic soles. Warm socks are a must, as are warm gloves and hats. They'll also need sunglasses. At the hostel, students will be accommodated in 3 to 4-bedded rooms, with ensuite facilities, towels, television, safety deposit box and hairdryer. Each child must bring a sleeping bag and pillowcase, a notebook and a basic pencil case. They'll also need swimwear for the Blue Lagoon trip. This should be packed in the hand luggage so that it's accessible on day one. They should also bring any medication they need and some plasters, just in case their shoes aren't as comfortable as they thought they would be. Spending money is required only for gifts and souvenirs. I suggest you allow £40 for this. Students are responsible for looking after their own money. Students will also be responsible for looking after any of the valuable items they bring on the trip. Cameras and smartphones are not covered on the insurance policy. Please check your home insurance to see what cover you may have for these items. If they bring a camera, make sure it's in a waterproof bag. On the subject of phones, they must comply with any requests to turn off equipment. Also, remember to pack some spare batteries or chargers along with an adapter plug. Thank you to those parents who've already handed in their children's passports at the start of this meeting. For those of you who didn't get this message, please could they be passed to me in school by Friday of this week. That's the 27th of February. Lastly, please could you check the details on the pupil information sheet are accurate. When you've done this, please initial the sheet to acknowledge that this information is correct and return it to the appropriate teacher when you leave.
Now listen to the recording a second time and check your answers.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this information meeting on the trip to Iceland. I'm Angus Medler, the head of geography. Let's start with some key times and dates. The trip is from Thursday the 26th of March to Monday the 30th of March. We meet here at the school on the Thursday at 6:15 in the morning for the coach to the airport. Our flight, RJA 202, departs at 10:45. For the return journey, we're on flight BA804, departing Reykjavik on Monday afternoon at 3:00, and plan to arrive back here at the school at 10:30. Once we arrive in Iceland, we'll head for the Blue Lagoon for a swim in its warm geothermal waters. We'll then check in at the Vik Hostel and have our evening meal. The following day will be spent on the Golden Circle tour, stopping at Pingvellir National Park and then at the country's parliament. After lunch, the tour continues to Gullfoss, Iceland's most beautiful waterfall, and then to the Geysir geothermal area with its hot springs. The last stop of the day will be a visit to a volcano. On Saturday, we're off to Skaftafell in the south of the country to explore its famous glacier, the world's largest one outside the polar region. On Sunday, we've arranged a whale-watching tour for a chance to see humpback and minke whales, followed by a trip to the Westman Islands and their cliffs, which are home to 10 million puffins and other seabirds. Monday morning will be spent sightseeing around the capital on foot, before setting off on the journey home. It's certainly a packed itinerary, from which we hope your child will gain an insight into the geology and nature of Iceland. I'd now like to turn to more practical matters. Each student has a baggage allowance of 1 20-kilogram suitcase and 1 piece of hand luggage. This must be a small rucksack. Please make sure all luggage your child brings closes or zips securely to keep valuables and money safe. You'll also need to make sure your child's name is written on their bags to avoid confusion. As for kit, your children will require indoor clothing and footwear for the hostel and flights. They'll also need a waterproof jacket and trousers, thermal layers, robust walking trainers or boots. And please note this does not include anything with plastic soles. Warm socks are a must, as are warm gloves and hats. They'll also need sunglasses. At the hostel, students will be accommodated in 3 to 4-bedded rooms, with ensuite facilities, towels, television, safety deposit box and hairdryer. Each child must bring a sleeping bag and pillowcase, a notebook and a basic pencil case. They'll also need swimwear for the Blue Lagoon trip. This should be packed in the hand luggage so that it's accessible on day one. They should also bring any medication they need and some plasters, just in case their shoes aren't as comfortable as they thought they would be. Spending money is required only for gifts and souvenirs. I suggest you allow £40 for this. Students are responsible for looking after their own money. Students will also be responsible for looking after any of the valuable items they bring on the trip. Cameras and smartphones are not covered on the insurance policy. Please check your home insurance to see what cover you may have for these items. If they bring a camera, make sure it's in a waterproof bag. On the subject of phones, they must comply with any requests to turn off equipment. Also, remember to pack some spare batteries or chargers along with an adapter plug. Thank you to those parents who've already handed in their children's passports at the start of this meeting. For those of you who didn't get this message, please could they be passed to me in school by Friday of this week. That's the 27th of February. Lastly, please could you check the details on the pupil information sheet are accurate. When you've done this, please initial the sheet to acknowledge that this information is correct and return it to the appropriate teacher when you leave.
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two. Part two. In this part, you will hear an interview with an ocean rower. Listen and answer the questions. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Rebecca Jones, you were in your 30s when you started rowing across oceans. Why was that?
Well, I had spent 11 years working in an office, mostly as a management consultant, and had enjoyed a very conventional sort of London lifestyle, but ultimately I discovered that it wasn't really making me happy. I had the big house, the fast cars and all the stuff that goes with it. But I came to realise that there was something else I needed. Something that would give me a sense of accomplishment. That realisation was life-changing and it led to me rowing across the Atlantic Ocean on my own.
That's an enormous jump. So what is it about rowing you particularly enjoy?
I'm not sure it's really true to say I enjoy rowing. In fact, I do it because it's a fantastic way to challenge myself, to find my personal limits. It's also great in that it gives me a platform for talking about the environment. But as far as the activity itself goes, it's hard and uncomfortable. There are a few things about rowing that I miss when I'm on dry land, but not many.
That's surprising. So why did you decide to row across the Atlantic, then?
Well, At the time, I had two main goals. I wanted to test my limits and find out what I was really capable of. And I felt I needed a platform for my environmental message, a way to get people's attention. Rowing on my own across the ocean absolutely met both those criteria. The environmental message is particularly important to me. I'm not arrogant enough to think I'm changing the world, but I do think I'm making ripples, or at least starting to. In my view, when people become aware of environmental issues, this is the first step on the way to change. I want people to realise that every single little action they take does have an impact on the environment.
Oh yes, I totally agree. And people reacted well to your blogs and pictures of the state of the ocean. We also saw your pictures of when your boat rolled over. That must have been very scary. Can you tell us about that?
As you might imagine, the weather was so rough sometimes. I was actually in the cabin each of the three times it happened, which was pretty lucky because I spent most of my time on deck. Unfortunately, a strap I had to hold me down while sleeping ripped out from the floor on the second capsize. Oh, no matter how carefully you think you've got everything lashed down, a few things still escape. It's such a mess to clear up afterwards. And it's just fairly traumatic as well, really. Because you're lying there asleep, and suddenly your whole world turns upside down. Then, after that, you're just bracing yourself the whole time, wondering when it'll capsize again. So you're on your guard the whole time.
That must have been absolutely terrifying. But it clearly didn't put you off. I hope your other projects are less stressful. Could you perhaps now tell us a bit more about your work as an environmental campaigner?
Yes, of course. On the practical side, in general, I do a lot of work around the issue of plastic pollution in the oceans. Right now, I'm working on a programme called the Green Team, due to launch next year, which will be a series of beach cleanups around Britain. This particular interest stems from witnessing the pollution problem firsthand on the Pacific, where I rowed around the outskirts of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. But there's also a more philosophical side to my work. The environmental challenge is not about saving the planet. It's really about saving the humans. We're part of this web of life, and if we damage a part of that web, we're actually hurting ourselves. We imagine that we're separate from nature, but really we're part of it, and it is part of us, and we need to respect that by replacing what we use.
Oh, I quite agree. That's a powerful message and one that more people are tuning into. Now, you've travelled solo. What advice would you give to others who want to travel alone?
Going alone definitely has its challenges, but there's no doubt that it's worthwhile. If you ever want to get to grips with your personal difficulties, going it alone is the way to do it. I believe that getting to know yourself and acquiring self-mastery are two of the most important things you can do, and fundamentally affect the way you are in the world, in your career, and in your relationships. They affect even your health. But if you're not sure going solo is for you, give it a try on a smaller scale. It might take you a little while to get used to it, but who knows? You might find you like it.
Oh, that's a good idea. Rebecca, just to finish off, if you had one piece of advice for young people, especially for girls, what would it be?
To let go of your self-limiting beliefs, I think. Because I used to constrain myself a lot by believing I couldn't do things without actually trying them. There are two qualities you need: discipline and determination. If you've got these, it's absolutely amazing what you can achieve. I look back over what I've achieved in the last 7 years and I just think, wow, 12 years ago I would never have believed I could do that. Why not just try things and see? What's the worst that can happen? The oceany bits of the last 7 years have been really tough. But when I look back at what they've given me, the self-confidence and the belief that I can, this has been absolutely invaluable. If that was something I could wrap up in a bow and give as a gift to people, I really would.
Now listen to the recording a second time and check your answers.
Rebecca Jones, you were in your 30s when you started rowing across oceans. Why was that?
Well, I had spent 11 years working in an office, mostly as a management consultant, and had enjoyed a very conventional sort of London lifestyle, but ultimately, I discovered that it wasn't really making me happy. I had the big house, the fast cars, and all the stuff that goes with it. But I came to realise that there was something else I needed, something that would give me a sense of accomplishment. That realisation was life-changing, and it led to me rowing across the Atlantic Ocean on my own.
That's an enormous jump. So what is it about rowing you particularly enjoy?
I'm not sure it's really true to say I enjoy rowing. In fact, I do it because it's a fantastic way to challenge myself, to find my personal limits. It's also great in that it gives me a platform for talking about the environment. But as far as the activity itself goes, it's hard and uncomfortable. There are a few things about rowing that I miss when I'm on dry land, but not many.
That's surprising. So why did you decide to row across the Atlantic then?
Well, at the time, I had two main goals. I wanted to test my limits and find out what I was really capable of. And I felt I needed a platform for my environmental message, a way to get people's attention. Rowing on my own across the ocean absolutely met both those criteria. The environmental message is particularly important to me. I'm not arrogant enough to think I'm changing the world, but I do think I'm making ripples, or at least starting to. In my view, when people become aware of environmental issues, this is the first step on the way to change. I want people to realise that every single little action they take does have an impact on the environment.
Oh yes, I totally agree. And people reacted well to your blogs and pictures of the state of the ocean. We also saw your pictures of when your boat rolled over. That must have been very scary. Can you tell us about that?
As you might imagine, the weather was so rough sometimes. I was actually in the cabin each of the three times it happened, which was pretty lucky because I spent most of my time on deck. Unfortunately, a strap I had to hold me down while sleeping ripped out from the floor on the second capsize. Oh, no matter how carefully you think you've got everything lashed down, a few things still escape. It's such a mess to clear up afterwards. And it's just fairly traumatic as well, really. Because you're lying there asleep, and suddenly your whole world turns upside down. Then, after that, you're just bracing yourself the whole time, wondering when it'll capsize again. So you're on your guard the whole time.
That must have been absolutely terrifying. But it clearly didn't put you off. I hope your other projects are less stressful. Could you perhaps now tell us a bit more about your work as an environmental campaigner?
Yes, of course. On the practical side, in general, I do a lot of work around the issue of plastic pollution in the oceans. Right now, I'm working on a program called the Green Team, due to launch next year, which will be a series of beach cleanups around Britain. This particular interest stems from witnessing the pollution problem firsthand on the Pacific, where I rowed around the outskirts of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. But there's also a more philosophical side to my work. The environmental challenge is not about saving the planet. It's really about saving the humans. We're part of this web of life, and if we damage a part of that web, we're actually hurting ourselves. We imagine that we're separate from nature, but really we're part of it, and it is part of us, and we need to respect that by replacing what we use.
Oh, I quite agree. That's a powerful message, and one that more people are tuning into. Now, you've travelled solo. What advice would you give to others who want to travel alone?
Going alone definitely has its challenges, but there's no doubt that it's worthwhile. If you ever want to get to grips with your personal difficulties, going it alone is the way to do it. I believe that getting to know yourself and acquiring self-mastery are two of the most important things you can do, and fundamentally affect the way you are in the world, in your career, and in your relationships. They affect even your health. But if you're not sure going solo is for you, give it a try on a smaller scale. It might take you a little while to get used to it, but who knows? You might find you like it.
Oh, that's a good idea. Rebecca, just to finish off, if you had one piece of advice for young people, especially for girls, what would it be?
To let go of your self-limiting beliefs, I think. Because I used to constrain myself a lot by believing I couldn't do things without actually trying them. There are two qualities you need: discipline and determination. If you've got these, it's absolutely amazing what you can achieve. I look back over what I've achieved in the last 7 years and I just think, wow, 12 years ago I would never have believed I could do that. Why not just try things and see? What's the worst that can happen? The oceany bits of the last 7 years have been really tough, but when I look back at what they've given me, the self-confidence and the belief that I can, this has been absolutely invaluable. If that was something I could wrap up in a bow and give as a gift to people, I really would.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. In this part, you will hear an extract from a radio programme on the history of balloons. Listen and complete the sentences. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each completed answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
People have dreamt of flying through the air for thousands of years, and balloons were the first way for us to take to the skies. The history of ballooning is longer than it may appear at first glance, with the first unmanned hot air balloons being used in 3rd century China. These were flying lanterns, and were employed by the military for communication purposes. Although materials known to the Chinese at that time could have allowed them to build a balloon which could carry a person, there's no archaeological evidence they tried to do this. It wasn't until 1783 in France that the Montgolfier brothers used hot air to get the first sizable balloon to rise under its own power. Their first balloons were made out of paper. They were simply a huge bag which the brothers would hold over a fire. When the bag was full of hot air, they would let go, and it would float away. Glue wasn't readily available in those days, so the balloons had to be assembled with buttons and buttonholes. The bags couldn't be crumpled up either, so they were a problem to transport. At the time of these early experiments, people were very superstitious, and many believed it was fatal for someone to leave the ground. On one early balloon flight, a chicken, a sheep, and a duck were sent up. When they arrived back all in one piece, it was clear it was safe for humans. Shortly afterwards, the first manned flight took place when Frenchman de Rozier flew the Montgolfier's paper and cloth balloon for almost 25 minutes before a fire forced him down. These early balloons were quick to catch fire, and part of the balloon's equipment was a long pole with a sponge on the end. When a spark went up and started a fire, the sponge was soaked in water and used to put the fire out. In December 1783, French scientist Jacques Charles made the first manned flight in a balloon filled with hydrogen. The Charles balloon was made of silk and coated with tree sap to seal the gas into the bag. In his balloon, Charles reached 3,000 feet and travelled about 16 miles in 45 minutes. The flight was successful, but the sight of a giant balloon was so unfamiliar that it caused terror when it landed in the countryside just outside Paris. Local people, on seeing it, thought the balloon was a monster and destroyed it by throwing rocks at it. For his next flight, Charles had a new balloon and thousands of spectators. By this time, balloon flight had caught the people's imagination. Parisians were so enthusiastic about this new phenomenon that hundreds helped finance the building of the balloon by paying for the privilege of a close-up view of it taking off. What followed can be described as a balloon craze. Soon, balloon designs began to appear in ladies' fashion, clocks and furniture. Even coaches were shaped like balloons to let passengers imagine they were flying as they travelled along the road. In 1785, in an effort to extend the length of the flight, de Rozier designed a balloon which combined hot air and hydrogen. An open fire produced hot air which warmed a cylinder containing hydrogen. Unfortunately, hydrogen is highly flammable, and de Rozier's balloon blew up shortly after takeoff. From then on, balloonists did not mix hot air and hydrogen. They used only hydrogen gas, and later non-flammable helium for lift. Soon the hot air balloon became obsolete. It could make short flights, but it seemed dangerous to take fire into the sky. However, some 200 years later, scientists returned to a de Rozier-style balloon, which would be the first to fly non-stop around the world. This updated version, known as the Breitling Orbiter, combined two sources of lift whereby a large, closed pocket of helium was warmed by hot air. In 1999, the orbiter completed the 25,000-mile journey in just under 20 days. The main challenges for the pilots were to manage the changing altitude of the balloon and achieve their goal before the fuels ran out. Changes in the materials used to make the balloon bag also contributed to the success of the Breitling orbiter flight. The invention of a new plastic balloon bag, which was as thin as the cling film used for sealing food items, represented a quantum leap in balloon design. The material was incredibly strong and light. It was now possible to make a balloon capable of holding 1 million cubic feet of helium. This meant that the balloons could fly higher into the atmosphere. Journeys into space were now within reach. The high-altitude balloon flights of the 1950s provided scientists with important data for the manned flights to the moon in the 1960s. In recent years, hot air balloons have made a return to the sky and are generally used for recreation. It's a popular choice of activity for many who enjoy the exceptional quiet and bird's-eye view of the landscape when on a balloon flight. There's no feeling of movement, yet travellers can see they are gliding across the landscape. Hot air ballooning is also developing as a popular sport, where people compete in races of speed and skill. Balloon festivals now attract large audiences, where spectators can watch dozens of balloons in the sky at the same time.
Now listen to the recording a second time and check your answers.
People have dreamt of flying through the air for thousands of years, and balloons were the first way for us to take to the skies. The history of ballooning is longer than it may appear at first glance, with the first unmanned hot air balloons being used in 3rd century China. These were flying lanterns and were employed by the military for communication purposes. Although materials known to the Chinese at that time could have allowed them to build a balloon which could carry a person, there's no archaeological evidence they tried to do this. It wasn't until 1783 in France that the Montgolfier brothers used hot air to get the first sizable balloon to rise under its own power. Their first balloons were made out of paper. They were simply a huge bag which the brothers would hold over a fire. When the bag was full of hot air, they would let go, and it would float away. Glue wasn't readily available in those days, so the balloons had to be assembled with buttons and buttonholes. The bags couldn't be crumpled up either, so they were a problem to transport. At the time of these early experiments, people were very superstitious, and many believed it was fatal for someone to leave the ground. On one early balloon flight, a chicken, a sheep, and a duck were sent up. When they arrived back all in one piece, it was clear it was safe for humans. Shortly afterwards, the first manned flight took place when Frenchman de Rozier flew the Montgolfier's paper and cloth balloon for almost 25 minutes before a fire forced him down. These early balloons were quick to catch fire, and part of the balloon's equipment was a long pole with a sponge on the end. When a spark went up and started a fire, the sponge was soaked in water and used to put the fire out. In December 1783, French scientist Jacques Charles made the first manned flight in a balloon filled with hydrogen. The Charles balloon was made of silk and coated with tree sap to seal the gas into the bag. In his balloon, Charles reached 3,000 feet and travelled about 16 miles in 45 minutes. The flight was successful, but the sight of a giant balloon was so unfamiliar that it caused terror when it landed in the countryside just outside Paris. Local people, on seeing it, thought the balloon was a monster and destroyed it by throwing rocks at it. For his next flight, Charles had a new balloon and thousands of spectators. By this time, balloon flight had caught the people's imagination. Parisians were so enthusiastic about this new phenomenon that hundreds helped finance the building of the balloon by paying for the privilege of a close-up view of it taking off. What followed can be described as a balloon craze. Soon, balloon designs began to appear in ladies' fashion, clocks and furniture. Even coaches were shaped like balloons to let passengers imagine they were flying as they travelled along the road. In 1785, in an effort to extend the length of the flight, de Rozier designed a balloon which combined hot air and hydrogen. An open fire produced hot air which warmed a cylinder containing hydrogen. Unfortunately, Hydrogen is highly flammable, and de Rozier's balloon blew up shortly after takeoff. From then on, balloonists did not mix hot air and hydrogen. They used only hydrogen gas, and later non-flammable helium for lift. Soon the hot air balloon became obsolete. It could make short flights, but it seemed dangerous to take fire into the sky. However, some 200 years later, scientists returned to a de Rozier-style balloon, which would be the first to fly non-stop around the world. This updated version, known as the Breitling Orbiter, combined two sources of lift whereby a large, closed pocket of helium was warmed by hot air. In 1999, the orbiter completed the 25,000-mile journey in just under 20 days. The main challenges for the pilots were to manage the changing altitude of the balloon and achieve their goal before the fuels ran out. Changes in the materials used to make the balloon bag also contributed to the success of the Breitling orbiter flight. The invention of a new plastic balloon bag, which was as thin as the cling film used for sealing food items, represented a quantum leap in balloon design. The material was incredibly strong and light. It was now possible to make a balloon capable of holding 1 million cubic feet of helium. This meant that the balloons could fly higher into the atmosphere. Journeys into space were now within reach. The high-altitude balloon flights of the 1950s provided scientists with important data for the manned flights to the moon in the 1960s. In recent years, hot air balloons have made a return to the sky and are generally used for recreation. It's a popular choice of activity for many who enjoy the exceptional quiet and bird's-eye view of the landscape when on a balloon flight. There's no feeling of movement, yet travellers can see they are gliding across the landscape. Hot air ballooning is also developing as a popular sport, where people compete in races of speed and skill. Balloon festivals now attract large audiences, where spectators can watch dozens of balloons in the sky at the same time.
That is the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklets to be collected. Thank you, and good luck.